and I give you Joe from Edmond, Oklahoma.
I'm Joe Linehan, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Joe.
My sobriety date is October 7th, 1972, and I'm as grateful as I know how to be for that period of time. Amy, thanks for the invitation, the committee, and a great deal. You know, you're so fortunate in North Carolina. I do have travel a little bit, you know, there's something special about North Carolina, and I was thinking about that earlier, why that is. And I think it's because North Carolina has had unbelievable leadership for a long, long time. You ought to be very thankful for those folks that have plowed the ground and got it ready for you when you got here. So I think this thing here will go a little better if there's a story with it. And I'll tell you, I hate telling what goes through my mind, but sometimes I just feel compelled to do it. But you see the two guys and a lady there, right? Well, I saw that today, and I got to thinking, and it reminded me of when I came out of a blackout in a shower with two strangers. And the guy was laughing, but the lady wasn't happy. Did y'all check this tie out? It's a nice tie. I borrowed that from Dave Cook. He said he won it in a humility contest. It is great to be here. It's great to be, with my people. I looked for you guys a long, long time, and I've been so, so blessed in Alcoholics Anonymous to be with the right people at the right time. And Tom started sponsoring me in 2001, and once again, my sobriety took a huge turn. And, I've made several trips to North Carolina. I always enjoyed it. I couldn't believe how many people that I truly know here in North Carolina, and it's a great feeling to, feel like you're coming home. I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And I'm going to tell you a story, and some of it's even true. I was a guy that I got here just like the rest of you. Who would not say that an infant child is not a spiritual being? And that's the way I got here, and stayed that way for a period of time, probably maybe 4 years. And somewhere around 4 or 5 years old, I just kind of made a turn. I can't pinpoint that when that happened, but what I started pursuing was what man told me would make me happy. And slowly but surely, I walked away from that thing that I was handed at birth. And, I've looked and looked and looked, and I tried to find whatever that was. And not till I got to Alcoholics Anonymous was it revealed to me that it's deep down inside of me. And that through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that I could uncover it. And been so blessed, so blessed. I made my first AA meeting in May 1968, and I walked into a glum lot. I'm 23 years old, and there's four of the oldest human beings I've ever seen in my life. And Dave can tell you back then, they didn't talk about one day at a time. They talked about not drinking forever. You're 23 years old, that's a while. I looked at them, I thought, hell, it might be the next 30 minutes. Those guys are old. But what those guys did for me, then and was they spoon-fed me Alcoholics Anonymous, unbeknownst to me. They were the first place that I ever was around that didn't talk about my drinking. They just talked about theirs. I'd been lots and lots of places they wanted to talk about my drinking, but when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, They talked about their drinking, and it gave me an opportunity to identify. Now, the bad news is I drank for 4 more years. And if you've experienced any of that, you know that once you're exposed to the true nature of the malady, your drinking has changed forever. And you thought you had remorse and guilt and all that before. Well, let them lay that, like Mike says, they put a booger on you. And, you know, my life, it was just changed, and my drinking was just never the same. Let's go back a little bit. My mother was a school teacher. I'm the youngest of three. I got 2 older sisters. Actually, I'm an only child of 3, if you know what I'm saying. I never even gave it a thought that my mother had 2 other kids and a husband and a job and what have you. Come on, I wanted what I wanted. I wanted it then, you know. But my mother came home one day, and I was somewhere between 4 or 5 years old, and I had the babysitter pinned up in the pantry. And I had a stack of green beans, and every time she'd look out, I'd ding her with one of them green beans, you know. And, you know, I tell you, my mother started right there, you know. She said she didn't know whether to whip me or the babysitter. Something wrong with that picture. And, you know, I did pretty well. Got into the 3rd grade, and I liked it so well, I did it a couple times. I got to the 4th grade, and I had this beautiful, beautiful teacher. Her name was Ruby Matthews, and I loved her like she was my grandmother or something. She was just a great woman. But I was acting out, you know, and we were having a spelling test, and she was sitting up there, and we'd get in line, and you'd hand her the book, and she'd check off your spelling words, and I knew I didn't have any right, so I'm standing behind her, and I'm going like this with my spelling book. And the class snitch says, "Miss, he's acting like he's hitting you with the book." And she said, "Joe, if you want to hit me with that book, you go ahead." I said, "Oh no, Miss Matthews, I wouldn't even think of that. I'm sorry, you know." She says, "No, if you want to hit me with that book, go ahead." She shouldn't have asked me the second time. Oh, I made it count too. I mean, I can see that. That old gray hair shot out there, them glasses fell down her nose. She started bawling. I started bawling. Took me to the principal, and she started bawling. My mother shows up. She starts bawling. I ain't had a drink yet. I needed one. You know. Obviously, I was restless, irritable, and discontented, you know. But anyway, things went pretty decent for a while. Got to the 8th grade, and I don't know if anybody noticed, and I hate to draw attention to it, but I've got extremely big ears. And I've actually had to grow into them. I had them from day one. I mean, sensitive about those ears. Now, one time Tom and I were on the same podium, and I think Wallace nudged old Steve, and he said, "You ever see 2 sets of ears like that?" I've always been sensitive about, you know, people say things to you like call you jughead, you know, or say you look like a taxi cab coming down the street with both back doors open, you know. And you get that, you know, and you're kind of sensitive anyway, and you get to thinking about it, and you can actually watch in the mirror and watch them grow. You know, get out in the wind and you can feel them, you know. And, but anyway, I'm in math class there, and Ms. Umphers, and I don't know what I was doing, but for some reason or another, she reached over there and grabbed me by the ear and gave me a jerk. And the next thing I know, I clocked her, and as she went down, I kicked her. You ever had those moments where right in the middle of that, you say, "Oh, no, this ain't good." Oh, well, I got a 3-day suspension. I thought it would be a holiday. My dad tried to get about 10 days of work out of me on the farm. And, you know, the following year was when I was to be introduced to alcohol at 15 years old. And, you know, the idea I had of myself at 15 years old, I was little, I was ugly, I was dumb, I was poor, I hated every aspect of my life. And you know, we got invited with some older guys to go out and drink, and I did that. And I think someone, Jerry's talked about it last night, that I can remember that just like it was last night. You know, and I remember taking a drink of that beer, and it didn't taste well, and I didn't want to cough it up or anything like that. I wanted to be part of that bunch, and they said, "What do you think?" And I said, "Oh, it's good, you know." And I didn't drink all that much, but something very, very special happened for me. And that feeling of inferiority and that feeling of inadequacy and those great big ears and, you know, all that stuff just kind of seemed to go away. I had a cloud that had followed me around for, I guess I was conscious of that fear, you know, maybe at 5, 6, 7 years old. And I was a long time sober before I ever found the bottom of all that. And I don't want anybody to take this out of wrong, is that I'm a third generation Joe Linehan alcoholic. And my dad was never a player in our house. He was always working or gone, or he died when I was 8 years old. And but I was much more affected by my mother's reaction to alcoholism than I was the actual alcoholism. My mother was one of those gals that was going to keep everything together. She had 3 kids. She never knew if my dad was going to come home, if he'd keep a job. He was one of those guys, the grass was always a little greener. And so that insecurity and all that stuff, and our book talks about, you know, living with the alcoholic makes the family neurotic. And all 3 kids have had difficulty with this thing called life. Mine manifests itself in alcoholism. And I think I'm the lucky one of the 3. You know, my 2 sisters, you know, read the Bible and everything and then worry about everything on this planet, you know. And they think I'm nuts because I don't worry about nothing, you know. Anyway, we start this little drinking career out, and the first night, I mean, I've always loved women. Oh, I loved women. Scared to death of them. You know, just absolutely, I just get paralyzed when I was around them. And by the time I'm 15 years old, I've been so full of lust, you know, that I just drool with it, you know. We'd go to them little old dances, you know, and the boys over here and the girls over here, and I'd sit over there and I'd look at them girls, you know, and I'd get that look and that drool come down, you know, and I could see myself, you know, getting with one of them, you know what I mean? And I didn't know what all that meant, but I knew I could do it, you know. I just. I didn't know that hooking up meant something that it does nowadays. It means something totally different when I was a kid. But you know, just scared to death of them. And, you know, that first night that I drank, you know, the guys could see that I'm getting off on that stuff. So they take me to the local drive-in. The drive-ins were the big thing back then. And I run down through that drive-in, and I tried to fight every man in there. And I propositioned every woman. I mean, 15 years of lust, come on out, man, I'm telling you. And I woke up, I got sick that night. Oh, my God, I tell you what. People have talked about being sick, but I think I've been sicker than anybody. I think this happened. I'm not certain, but I think it happened. I was so sick one time, I passed a green bean through my sinuses. But that night I got extremely sick, and I woke up. I was laying in that bed, and I kind of got in the house there and didn't make too much noise and what have you, and kind of took a deep breath and laid back in that bed, and that bed did something it had never done before. It just made about a 360. And I thought, whoa, I can't handle much of that, you know, and I kind of took a deep breath, and it did it again. And then it took off. Now, I'm a quick study. I hang my leg off the side and try to drag it, slow it down, you know. Woo! You know where you need to go and it's too late. You know what I mean? I got up the next morning. I had about 110 temperature. Every time my heart would beat, I thought my head would explode. And I'm sitting beside the bed there and I'm thinking, my God, I propositioned Margene last night. Whew, and I tried to fight Leroy. And all this started coming back to me, and I'm trying to think, what am I going to say when I see him? I wish that hadn't happened. And then I just rolled over. I need to get dressed, get the pool hall, and thank those guys because I want to do that again. I think alcoholics are the only ones. You know, I chewed tobacco one time, and I was done. I wish alcohol had been that way with me. I mean, the sicker I got, the more I wanted it. You know what I mean? Just, whew. Anyway, that was the beginning of my drinking career, which was for some of you a very short time, 12 years, in fact, from the time I had my first drink till I entered Alcoholics Anonymous. When you're 15 years old, you got to hustle that booze and what have you. So we collected all of our money at school, and we knew one of the guy's mom worked in a beer joint. And I got this old boy off the side. I said, hey, your mom get us some beer? He said, yeah. Now, you can bear in mind, this is 1961, 60 or 61, somewhere along in there. And we give him $20, and he comes back with a case of Metz beer. Any of you ever drink any Metz beer? That's God working in your life right there, huh? For $20 back then, $20 would buy a pickup load of beer. But we got a case. But anyway, we took it down to the creek and smoked cigars and drank that Metz beer and, you know, fell down and fell off in the creek and wet our pants and had a hell of a time, you know. But I'll tell you what, that Metz beer is so bad, I took it and had it analyzed. And I sent it off. And I still got the letter. It said, Dear Mr. Linehan, we believe that your horse has diabetes. Anyway, I was having a rough time at school. Alcohol didn't help that any, you know, and I just had a hard, hard time with reading in particular, and just a complete, just acted out all the time. And anyway, I got kicked out my second senior year. Now, if you'll figure that up, I did the third several times. I'm thinking I'm 18, 19, I'm probably close to 20 years old, and I'm still walking to high school. You know, I have dreams, I'm still up there. You know, But anyway, they kicked me out my second senior year, and that was fine with me. And I went off and got a job, and I left my little girlfriend back at school. And she was 3 years younger than me, and we were going to get married at Christmas her senior year. And we had to step that up. She got pregnant, and we got married in September. And quite a wedding. Probably a third of this crowd. And I think there were eight people that I counted up were sober, and everybody else was drunk. I was so drunk that my best man had to hold me up to take the pictures, you know. Her daddy was about, 5 foot and weighed about 300. The preacher says, who gives this woman away? He kind of looks around and he says, her mother does. You know, he didn't want any part of it, you know. Bless her heart, I believe she hooked up with me to get out of an alcoholic home. And she jumped from the frying pan to the fire. You know, we had a little baby, and that baby came premature. And that was probably 1964, 65, somewhere along in there. And that baby lived 18 hours. And I stood there and I watched that child take every breath that she took in this world. And I never felt so helpless in my life. We had a little incubator, and she was so tiny, and she didn't have fingernails, and she didn't have just tiny. Her little skin looked like cellophane, and her little chest would just work and try to stay with us. And after 18 hours, we lost her, you know. And sadly, I used that little girl's life and death as an excuse for more drinking. I never looked at that until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, we lost the baby, and we had an alcoholic marriage. I mean, we'd bust up, and then we'd get back together, and we'd bust up, and she'd get an attorney, and I'd talk her out of it. And then, you know, we'd bust up again. She'd go move in with her mom and dad, and after a couple of weeks, I'd give up, and I'd go move in with them, too. You know, it's just crazy. And after 4 years, we were able to get a divorce. And that came at a great time because my girlfriend was pregnant. Oh, yeah. I get a divorce from her and have a little boy with this other lady. Man, I don't like this being the breadwinner and all the responsibility. I want out, and before I can get out, she gets pregnant again. So I'm through with her. I got to go, you know. And we get a divorce, and that came at a great time because my girlfriend was pregnant. I can shorten this up considerably because it goes on for a while. I had 3 sons in 10 months and 2 days. At different times, a couple of months a year, they're all the same age, all 3 of them. In 30 months, I had 4. I'm not near as old as I look. I'm tired. You know what I mean? In May 1968, I darkened the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time. I met that glum lot. I used to even call them the Four Horsemen. You know. They were rough. And one of them, and every group's got one, but one of them seemed like he was in charge. And no one ever said that, but he just seemed to be in charge. And he talked real loud. And have you ever been in church with a good hangover? You know, several rows back, and that preacher's bringing it down, and he just, like, he's got you. You just want to, you got on down. And that's the way Doc was. Every time he'd share it, it just seemed like, my mother's snitching me off or something. I mean, there's something going on here. I just knew he had an inside on me. And I hated him. I avoided him. And anytime we was around, I'd visit with a couple of the others, and then I was off and gone. You know, I was a guy that once I started drinking, I had absolutely no idea what would happen. If I ever start to tell you a story and it starts out something like, I was about half drunk one afternoon, it's a lie. You can bet right there. I ain't never been half drunk in my life. I might be half drunk when I wake up, but I'll guarantee you it won't be long. I'll be, you know, the book talks about that guy that's insanely drunk, you know, and that was me. You know, I just absolutely, like the book says, I tried different methods. I ended up just drinking beer. And, you know, that was, I could last a little longer. I guarantee you I could take a drink of hard liquor, and I'd black out within 5 minutes, just absolutely out. I think that's how I ended up in that shower, you know. But I'll just tell you a typical night where I'm going to control and enjoy my drinking. I go out, I'm going to play a little pool, you know, drink a beer or two, see some friends, and once again I get overserved. And I get in a fight with a guy, and somehow or another he ends up in the trunk of my car. Now I forget I got him, you know. I'd kind of come out of that blackout, and I'd think, man, what am I going to do with him? You know, I'd kind of hear him rustling around back there, you know. Before I could figure out what to do with him, I'd black out again, you know. It was a long evening, particularly for him, you know. This is December, December 26, 1969. He ain't got nothing on but a pair of slacks. He ain't got no shoes, shirt, nothing. And I don't think there's any heat in that trunk, and it's cold in Oklahoma, you know. Anyway, the best I could come up with, about 2 in the morning, I'd take him to my sister's house. Now, I live with my sister between marriages, and I'd always bring strange stuff home. I'd bring guns home. One time I had 3 ducks. And I get my sister and brother-in-law, 2 of the finest people that God ever created, and 3 gorgeous kids. And I get them up, and I said, "Hell, you won't even believe what I got tonight." And my brother-in-law, his sister, them 3 kids, I get them up 2 in the morning. We walk out there to the back of that car, and I reach over there, and I turn that deck lid flies up, and that guy looks out. My sister flips out, you know. Kind of scared me, you know. I closed that thing back down. Whoo! My brother-in-law turned around and he said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "I don't know. I just don't know, you know." Well, they went in the house and I just opened the trunk and walked off. I presume he run off somewhere in the night, you know. We're laughing about it that night. Brother-in-law said, "Man, you got to do something. You're crazy." And I said, "No, he shouldn't have done whatever he did. I don't know what it was. But it pissed me off, I can tell you that." But, next morning, the doorbell rings, and if you live like I live, you don't go to the door, you know. And I go... And there was cops for as far as you can see. And they arrested me and convicted me of kidnapping. And, like I didn't have enough trouble already. Now I've got a felony hanging over me, you know. Through the grace of God and a great couple of attorneys, you know, I got a 3-year probation on that deal. And before I could live that 3 years down, I got busted on a first-degree rape charge. And to this moment, I don't know whether you're looking at a guilty man or not. I don't think a day goes by that I don't think about that. Obviously, something happened. But I had an attorney, and the first question an attorney asked is, "What happened?" I don't have any idea. I don't have any idea. And anyway, I get thrown in the county jail, and I'm there forever, it seemed like. I think I did 100-something days or something. But I'd never been in a big jail for any length of time. I'd go in on Friday and get out on Monday morning or something like that. I'd been in a lot of those, you know, but this was a long, drawn-out process. And everybody was all excited about visitation day. And I thought, "Man, what's the big deal?" I said, "Oh, man," he said, "all family comes in, and, you know, we can visit with them and all that." So, hell, I kind of got excited about it too. And Tuesday rolled around, and I'm looking out that little window, and I see my mother come in. I thought, "Man, I knew she'd come. I'm her only son. I knew she'd come." Well, right behind her is my wife. And I thought, "Man, I can't believe she'd come, but boy, I'm glad she did. It's nice." Well, right behind her is another wife. And I'm thinking, "Damn." I kind of look up that window there, and I look back over to the right. I see my girlfriend, her husband. My mother wades through all them people, and she said, "Honey, I know there's been a terrible mistake. I'll have you out of there as soon as possible." I said, "For God's sakes, don't do it today." You know, after spending that much time in jail, and I can think about that stuff I had going on in my mind for that 100-plus days, you know, first I wasn't ever going to drink again. You know, then I kind of narrowed it down, well, I'll just drink on the weekends if somebody's in town, you know. I'll just drink in my hometown. Well, no, I'll just quit altogether. You know, not knowing that I didn't have the ability to do any of that. I didn't know. So I got out September. I was white as everybody's all sunburned up and everything, you know, in Oklahoma, and I looked like Casper the Ghost. They said, "Where you been?" I said, "The shade, man. I've been in the shade." But I, what time did I start? I charge you for overtime. You know, I wasn't out of that jail 24 hours dumb drunk. And things had really gone downhill for me. Any of you ever live in a car? Oh, you got to be a few car dwellers, you know. We're a special breed, you know. I lived 8 months in a Ford Falcon. Now, if you're going to live in a car, don't pick a Falcon. Man, this thing was perfect for an alcoholic, though. This thing was powder blue. Oh, yeah, except for that right front fender, it's red. I got all my tires behind the Goodyear store, you know, what they throwed away. I had a tire about that big on the right front. One about like that on the left rear. That thing drove down the road like that. Had a half a windshield. My blinker light always stayed on to the left. And I couldn't figure out why the law was always stopping me, you know. But the floorboard was all rusted out and had beautiful vinyl seats. Perfect. I lived behind a beer joint in that car. And I'd walk out of that beer joint and just open that Ford Falcon, just fall in there and pass out, wet my pants. It just run off the battle seats, right out that hole, right out on the ground. It's that kind of self-cleaning, you know. I turned that car over one night, and several times. And I ended up next to a porch, just kind of like right there, upside down. And when the debris quit flying around in it, I'm sitting on the headliner. Now, here's the keen alcoholic mind. I'm thinking, I'm upside down. Now, stay with me on this. I'm upside down, so I'm going to have to roll the window up to get out. I slide out from under there, and there's a great boy about his size standing on the front porch. Had a big old ball cap, T-shirt hit him about right there, you know. He said, "You having trouble?" I said, "Oh, man, I park like this all the time, you know." Then the reality of the thing set into me. Not only have I lost my transportation, I'd lost my home, you know. I filled out a job application one time, and I put my tag number down as an address. Oh, we could go on for that forever. I bought a beer joint one time for $70. Boy, it's nice. It was really nice. I bought half interest for $70. It's the best investment I've made to date. I stayed drunk for 6 months on that $70. But, you know, I ended up in a vacant house. And I'd got down, I had a little paper sack full of dirty clothes and a U-Haul quilt. That's all I owned. And my brother-in-law came by one day and he said, "Joe," he said, "if you'd consider going back to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll find you a place to live." And I was just at one of those spots, you know. I was just probably hungry and dirty and what have you. And I said, "Well, let's see what you can do." And he came back about an hour and he said, "Well, my mother said you could move in with him." And I knew his mother, known her most of my life. And I thought she seemed like a pleasant lady. So my mind's already thinking, well, she'll cook, and she'll clean, you know, wash this clothes up and what have you, and I'll lay over and heal up. And so that's kind of what happened. I went over there, she fixed dinner and washed my clothes, you know, and I went to bed. The next morning she wakes me up. She said, "Joe, you need a job." I said, "A job?" She said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, Pauline, I don't have a car." And I said, "If I had a car, I don't have a driver's license." I said, "You know," she said, "you go over to those apartments right over there and ask for a guy named Jay." So I go over there and I ask for Jay, and Jay takes me in for the interview. And he said, "Joe," he said, "I'm looking for a maintenance man." He said, "Can you paint?" And I said, "No, I can't paint at all." I get that stuff everywhere. I'm not good at all painting. He said, well, he said, could you clean? He said, you know, people leave these apartments rough. Should you just clean it up and get it ready for the next renter? And I said, no. I said, I ain't much on cleaning. I don't know nothing about it. And he said, well, can you mow grass? I said, no. I'm really out on that. I said, I never can get the thing started. And I said, I'm not good at yard work at all. He says, you know, I think you're the man I'm looking for. So I took a job as a maintenance man. I'm messing around with AA again. I hadn't drank in, you know, maybe 10 days or what have you. And anyway, Jay asked me one day, he kind of liked me. He said, Joe, are you married? Well, I could not remember. And so I said, no. And I said, why? And he said, well, I got a lady I want to introduce you to. And I said, okay. I said, where is she? He said, well, she's recuperating from some surgery. And I said, all right. He said, but soon she'll be around. So anyway, she was the kind of the assistant manager of the apartments there. So he called me in the office one day, and I walk in there, and there's a beautiful blonde lady. And he introduced me, and he just left the room. And I said, so you've had surgery? And she said, yeah, I've had some surgery. And I said, well, what kind? She said, now I'm going to AA. You know, I'm just getting a little AA. I said, what kind of surgery? And she said, just surgery. And you know how we are. I said, well, specifically, what kind of surgery did you have? She said, Joe, I had a hysterectomy. And I thought, well, that's God's will for me, for damn sure. I mean, it don't any game plainer than that, you know. And so I'd go on to AA, and she invited me over for dinner one night, and I went over to eat dinner, and I never would leave. And I just kind of moved in, and I'd go to AA, and then I'd come home, and I'd tell her what everybody said and all that, and, you know, I broke everybody's anonymity, and, you know. Anything that they might have told in confidence, you know, I just shared it with her because I knew she wouldn't, you know, a hairdresser, she wouldn't tell anybody, you know. No. On a Monday morning, I hadn't had a drink in probably 30 days, and the idea said, you know, if God is all that powerful, you know, in 30 days I'd gather up some of that God, and if God's all powerful, then surely he could help me moderate. So I thought, I heard something about social drinking, but I never heard it till I got to AA. And I didn't know nothing about it, but I thought, that's what I'm going to do. So the best I could do is I went and bought a can of beer at the Red Bud store, and I sat out there at the pickup truck and drank it. Went back to work. Next day I come out, and I have two. Go back to work. I've got it. Wednesday I had six or seven. Went back to work. Didn't do nothing after I got there, but I went back to work. And Thursday, I got drunk. I stole the company pickup, you know, just off and running. And that relationship, like all the rest, was over. I took a little construction job. And I don't know about you, but when I'm drinking and I get news, the first thing I think about is what I do. And I'm drunk on this construction job, and I hear that Shirley, this gal's favorite uncle, had passed away. I thought, well, I know she'd want me to take her to that funeral. And I showed up at her home in the morning of the funeral, and I'm dressed in a pair of cut-off Levi's and a T-shirt, and I hadn't seen a bath in two or three days or a razor. And I walked right into her house amongst her entire family and walked up to her, and when she looked up at me, if you're an alcoholic, I think you'll know what I'm describing here. There's a look that those folks have got that's every emotion known to man in that look. You know, there's disgust, there's pity, there's anger, there's just, and I'd seen that so many times. My mother, my sisters, my wives, just different people that loved and cared about me. But when she looked up at me that day, she touched me in a spot I'd never been touched before. Now, she never said a word to me. She didn't have to. It was evident she wasn't going anywhere with me. I turned and walked out of her house. And as I walked across her front yard, I had a thought. It wasn't an original thought, but it seemed to be entirely different. And the thought was, today's the day for you to stop drinking. And behind that just came this ocean or this wave of fear that I'd never experienced before. At that point, I'd stood in front of judges twice on capital offenses, so I thought I knew what it was to be drove up. But there was no fear that I could describe can match what I had that day. The next thought I had was an original thought. I'd never had this thought before, but it was just as plain as day, and the thought was, there's absolutely no way that you can stop drinking. And my knees buckled, and that fear just intensified, and it's a strange, strange thing. I've not had a drink since that moment. As long as I thought I could, I couldn't, and the very minute that I knew I could, I haven't had a drink since. Another paradox in Alcoholics Anonymous. I went back to AA, same four old guys, same guy. But this one was a veterinarian, the guy that was kind of in charge. And I don't know why I did this, but one night after a meeting, I walked up to him and I said, Doc, do you really think I'm an alcoholic? And he said, Joe, here at Alcoholics Anonymous, we just lay out the stuff. And he said, we allow every man the dignity to figure that out for themselves. He said, I'm going to make an exception with you. I'm going to call you alcoholic till I figure out what is wrong with you. But the very next thing I said to him was probably the most important question I ever asked another human being, and I have absolutely no idea where it came from. I said, would you help me? Would you be my sponsor? And he said, I'd love to talk to you about that. You come to my office. And the following day, I went to his office, and I went to the back of that veterinarian clinic, and he set me down, and he told me what it was to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, what he would expect of me and what he'd be willing to do. And I agreed to those terms, knowing that I was making a pact with the devil. He didn't like me, and I didn't like him, and it was a marriage made in heaven, I promise you. But, we just got in the middle of it. You know, I was unemployable at the time, so I spent my day either in his office or the insurance office down the street or the cafe down the street. And there was just different members that had different businesses. I went down there one afternoon, and Doc took me back in the office there, and he turned around and he said something to me, asked me a question. He said, Joe, you can't read, can you? And I was an expert at getting around that. Only a hand people on this planet knew that. And for some reason or another, I can remember that like it was yesterday. My head dropped, and I said, no, Doc, I can't read. And he said, well, boy, you're going to have to learn to read. And he said that with such conviction. I thought, well, maybe I could. Not doing anything anyway. So I would go back to the veterinarian clinic, and I learned to read out of the Field and Stream, Popular Mechanics, and the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I seemed to kind of pick it up pretty quick, and about 8-9 months sober, he asked me to read How It Works before the speaker meeting. I said, you want me to read it? He said, yeah, I want you to read it. And this is a very accomplished man. I'll guarantee you that was one of his proudest moments, to see me get up there and read How It Works before the speaker meeting. That speaker only had to talk about 20 minutes that night. We got through it. You know, he started me through the step, and Doc had an approach to it that's probably not there. He had to pick it up somewhere. But he believed that there was four spiritual principles that were as old as man, and that the 12 steps were wrapped around those four basic principles: surrender, confession, restitution, and witnessing. And that's the way he took me through the steps. Bearing those four things in mind. The first step, of course, surrender being the first step. You know, confession being the fifth step. The surrender being the ninth step. Restitution being the ninth step. And witnessing being the 12th step. And that's the way he bundled it up, and that's the way he passed it along to me. And, we were a small group of five people for a long, long time, but we were a very active group. It was a great time to be sober. You know, it was my first experience of being part of something that had some depth and weight and a little bit of something about it. I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've never looked back. I've never been without a sponsor. You know, I've never been without a home group. I've only had two home groups in 43 years. And, you know, we're an active three-legacy group. And someone was talking about a new meeting here today, you know, and it's my opinion, and you can do what you want to with that. We don't need any more meetings. We need good, solid groups. If you look out there at that triangle in our service, in our upside-down triangle, at the very top of that is not meetings. It's groups. It's groups that's involved in all three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, that's, you know, based on what Tom has kind of passed along to me and I've kind of passed along, you know, we've changed the complexion of the Alcoholics Anonymous in my hometown. I think it's fair to say, you know, I heard a guy this morning talk about his group was the best in the world. And I've made a lot of groups, but I don't think I've come anywhere close to making all of them. But what he's, I don't think it's good enough that my group's the best. You know, my neighboring group's got to be the best it can be also. Because I don't have any power, nor anybody else does, knows where that new man's going to walk into. And if you've been to some of the places I've been, you got to look real hard to find what I believe is Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, Jerry talked about it last night, sponsorship. You know, a little bit of structure, just a little bit of something about it. You know, a little bit of planning, a little bit of something going on there, a life before the meeting and a life afterwards. And that's the Alcoholics Anonymous that I love. You know, that's, you know, I know when I go to my group what's going to happen. And I go to a lot of groups just to see what might happen. You know what I mean? I don't care what time it is. I want to know how much time I got left.
You got whatever you need. 10 minutes.
And that's, when we get older, we all want to know that, isn't it? How much time I got left, you know? You know, let me run down just two little old men's that changed my entire life. I married that girl. You know, that one that I couldn't let her go. She was wealthy. Or at least in my mind, she was rich. She had a car and a TV. Gotta get her, you know. And we figured out after 10 years that wasn't a deal made in heaven, you know, and we got a divorce. And I went off into depression. I thought, man, I can't live with them drunk. I can't live with them sober. You know, it was just a bad, bad time. And early on, you know, probably 3 years sober, I'd made amends to a lady in Edmond whose daughter I'd had a little. How do you put that? Playtime with? Is that right? That didn't sound very good. I'm married to her now. I may make it sound good, Mike. Anyway, I'd made amends to her. And she ended up being a customer of mine, you know, after I bought a little service station. And we became close friends. And I went through that divorce, and she kind of helped me through it. I didn't know it, but she's kind of undermining the thing, and she's got the daughter's in Texas this time, and she hates his son-in-law, and the son-in-law ends up dying from an overdose and alcoholism. And she said, why don't you call Cheryl? So I called Cheryl, and we started a long distance, you know, biz and deal, and we start dating, and she's in Texas, and I'm in Oklahoma, and you know, finally, I said, you need to move to Oklahoma. And she said, well, if you can find me a job, I'll move. So I sponsored this guy that was the head of the accounting for this big insurance company. I called up. I said, Ken, he said, yes. And I said, I need you to do something today. And he said, okay, what's that? I said, I want you to call this girl in Texas and give her a job as an accountant for your insurance company. And he paused and he said, have her send me a resume. So I called her and I said, send Ken this guy a resume, and she did, and that evening she had a job and moved to Oklahoma. And we were trying to do, she'd had a lot of trouble with relationships, and obviously I had, so we tried to do things a little bit different. And she had a, I always remind her that when she came to Edmond, she had a Ford Escort and a kid hanging out of every window, you know. And I had a Chevy pickup and a kid hanging out of every window of it, you know. But, you know, we dated, and she called me one day and she said, I need you to meet me after the meeting, and let's have dinner, but I want just you to come. So we had dinner after the meeting, and she said, I've got to tell you something. If we're going to go any further with this deal. And I said, okay. I'm thinking she's going back to Texas. And she said, that oldest boy of mine, Eric, is your son. And when I left Edmond 11 years ago, unbeknownst to me, I was pregnant. And that boy is your son. I should have known it. He's just a little jackass, you know. So that's what I needed, one more kid, you know what I mean? And but anyway, we tried to put two families together best we could. And that was 32 years ago. And she's a very, very strong woman. Amy and some of the folks have met Cheryl, and she's an amazing woman. We've got, I never one time we were, there was kids were all there, and there were big commotion in the backyard and screaming and hollering. And she said, what's going on out there? And I said, well, your kids, my kids, killing our kid. You know, that boy's been trying to get sober since 1997. At this very moment, he's sitting in the penitentiary. He afforded me my first grandchild. When Katie was 2 years old, Eric walked off and left Katie and her mother. And, you know, Cheryl and I had to step in, and I got another shot at being a parent. And that little girl has done more to me and for me outside of Alcoholics Anonymous than anybody I know. When she's 3 years old, we're laying there watching cartoons. I'd never changed a diaper. I'd never watched a cartoon. I never did nothing with kids. She and I are laying in a big old king-sized bed. We're watching a cartoon. And she looks up at me. She's 3 years old. And she said, Papa, you're my best friend. And I'm telling you, it broke something inside of me that I didn't know existed. And it was my first experience with unconditional love. She's 22 years old. And getting ready to graduate from the University of Oklahoma. She was on the national championship, actually the captain of the national championship softball team this past year. And I've got 15 grandkids. So I need to talk to you all about some donations for Christmas this year. I gave you the story for your banner. Whoever gets that will be thinking about them, that surprise those people got in that shower. Y'all have been great. I've enjoyed Jerry. Great job last night. I've known Jerry a long, long time. You know, it's just good to be in a room where everybody's headed the same direction. You know, some of us are maybe a little further down the path. Maybe some of us have kind of stumbled. But, you know, alcoholism is the greatest thing that could have ever happened to me. I'm a guy that would have gone through this entire life and never had the opportunity to understand what it's all about, because I thought it was about what you get. And the truth of life is what you give. That's what's important. When that big book talks about everlasting life, it's talking about the things that people left here when they left, the gifts that they gave to life. It's an amazing thing to be a guy that had absolutely no reason in the world to succeed. But I was able to retire at a young age, done well. I know there's some military people here, and I want to tell you, John, you're one in particular, I want you to hear this story. Some of you older folks will remember back in the 60s and everything, they had a picture of Uncle Sam out in the post office. and said, Uncle Sam wants you like that. After they got me, they took it down. I'm not telling you I was a bad soldier, but they let me out early, just put it that way. It's been great to be here tonight. I'm looking forward for Steve tomorrow. We've got a couple of workshops going to go on tomorrow and stuff, and I'm looking forward to it. I love each and every one of you, and God bless you.